Hi, podcasters. Ira Flatow here with a request. You know from listening to the show that we deal in facts and realities. And one of those realities is that it takes many hundreds of thousands of dollars to make Science Friday and these free podcasts that hopefully you enjoy. The other reality is that we at Science Friday have to raise a great majority of that money ourselves. Yes, we get some from your donations to your public radio station, so please keep doing that. But that only covers a fraction of our costs. And sure, we get some money from the underwriting announcements here, but hardly enough to cover our expenses. Hundreds of thousands of you download these podcasts each week, each month. You have the power to keep us going. If every one of you gave us just a dollar, we could ensure the future of these broadcasts and these podcasts. We need your help. Please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the donate button there. Give us $1, $5, whatever you think it's worth to you to keep Science Friday part of your week. Please donate what you can at sciencefriday.com. And thanks. And now, on to the program. Are you ready to deal with the Earth as it heats up? For example, rising sea levels. Did you know that the Dutch are taking action now for the next 200 years? What do we need to do? Mark Hertzgaard is here with some advice. Plus, an ancient Egyptian physician first described cancer 4,000 years ago, long before there was even a word for it. But we're still struggling to understand the disease today. We'll talk about the history of cancer and new thinking about the directions of future research and treatment. Plus radiation, radioactivity, alpha, beta, gamma. Do these words mean anything to you? Do you know the difference between all this atomic terminology? We'll have some answers and your questions after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Detectors have picked up faint traces of radioactivity in rainwater falling in the U.S., a result of the ongoing nuclear crisis in Japan. We're talking very faint traces. Experts say that people in the U.S. have nothing to be concerned about. The fact that these signs of radioactive materials are being picked up is more a testament to the sensitivity of our detectors. But when people talk about radioactive rain, or radioactive milk, or spinach, or whatever. What are we actually talking about? What's in those consumables that we call them radioactive? What's the difference between radioactive and radiation? A cloud of radiation, what's that? Well, this hour, we're going to talk about some of the explanations of nuclear lingo and terms. Just what do all these things mean? Alpha, beta, gamma, neutrons, things like that. What are we talking about? It's been in the news so much we thought we'd stop and catch our breath and see what these terms actually mean. If you'd like to talk about that, our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCISFRI, or ask your question on Facebook at /SciFry. Let me introduce my guest. Steve Sugarman is a certified health physicist and is health physics project manager for the Radiation Emergency Assistance Center training site. That's a DOE project managed by the Oak Ridge Associated Universities in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thank you very much. How are you today?
Fine. Thank you. Do you find the public is just, doesn't understand all these different terminology items and things in there?
Well, you know, there sure is a lot of terminology to wrap your hand around, that's for sure. And there's been a little bit of confusion about what different words mean, that type of thing. So I think this is a great opportunity to maybe learn and expand our vocabulary a little bit.
All right. Let's start with item number one, the difference between radioactive and radiation.
Well, that's a very, common misconception, really, when people think about that. And really what we're talking about is the difference between being contaminated and being exposed. And when you're contaminated with a material, what that really means is that you have the material physically on you. And being exposed to it simply means you're in the presence of a radioactive material. So if you can imagine holding a sweetener packet, for instance, and that sweetener is radioactive, I can hold the outside of that packet and not get any of the material on my hands. So I'm simply being exposed. But when I open that packet and I get some on my hands or I put it in my coffee and swallow it, I'm now contaminated. So that's the real difference between those two words.
So there are actual particles of radioactive material on you when you get contaminated.
What you have is actually the material itself. and the radioactive material emits various types of radiation, alpha particles, beta particles, or gamma rays, for instance. But you're not contaminated with the alpha particle. You're contaminated with the material that emits the alpha particle.
Okay, and what different kinds of materials are there being emitted from the reactor?
Well, with regards to nuclear reactors, there can be various things that occur. Materials that emit alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays, all three are found in reactors.
Mm. And are they all equally as threatening to us, or are some more threatening than others?
Well, I would not use the word threatening as far as how radioactive materials go. Different emissions do have different biological effects associated with them. And basically what that comes down to is how efficient they are at creating ionization, which is simply the removing of an electron. And if you sort of think about it in terms of magnetism, and this is obviously not a magnet, but if you can imagine if you had a lot of South Pole BBs on the desk in front of you and a big North Pole magnet, as you got fairly close, there would be some interaction. And that would be something like what an alpha particle is, mm-hmm. fairly big, fairly strong charge. Or we can have a beta particle, which would be a much smaller, weaker magnet. Therefore, you would have to be much closer for it to interact. And common sense sort of dictates that that would not be as efficient at interacting.
Mm-hmm. Let's say you had all three close to your skin or on your skin, these particles. How would they affect your skin or penetration of your body differently?
Well, alpha particles, as a general rule, don't penetrate the outer layer of skin. So if I'm holding an alpha-emitting source in my hand, I'm not terribly concerned with that because the outer layer of skin is already dead. It's not, you know, going to get any worse, so I don't worry about that. Beta particles will penetrate a millimeter or so into tissue, which is getting past that dead layer of skin. So if I hold a beta-emitting source in my hand, I do have to have some concern about that living, you know, tissue underneath. And gamma rays act a lot like when you go to the hospital and get a chest X-ray. Much of what comes in the front side goes in the out the back. Obviously, in the hospital, you have to get to the film. So gamma rays are very penetrating, and many of them go straight through without interacting.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've heard different kinds of radionuclides involved in nuclear reactors. We've heard of uranium, plutonium, cesium, iodine. Can you walk us through what those are?
Well, all of these are various radioactive materials that are generated in a nuclear power plant. Cesium, iodine, these types of isotopes are what we call fission products. And they simply occur when the uranium atom is split, which is what the fission is the splitting of the atom. Mm-hmm. And when that splits, two other atoms are created. And cesium-137, for instance, is one of those things that's created, as is iodine. And there are hundreds of others. So there are many other things. And there are some that we have more of a, I don't want to use the word concern, but I'll use that. They're on our radar a little bit more because they're more predominantly produced.
Mm-hmm. We've heard people talk about radioactive plumes and radiation clouds. Do they mean really anything, or is the correct technology there, terminology there?
For me, I prefer not to use the word radioactive, a leak of radiation or radiation plume or anything like that. Really, all that is it's this radioactive material that has been released. And radioactive materials can be released, in a variety of things. But that's really all it is the material itself that is now airborne.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a call or two in here. Peter in Palisade. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Peter.
I was wondering about how radiation behaves in the atmosphere, and if it has mass, does it want to fall to the ground, and will it gravitate towards other masses in the air, like streams of smog and those kinds of things? How does it tend to behave? Right. Does it concentrate along certain lines?
See, now, Peter, you're using the word radiation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
See, now that's exactly what I'm talking about. How does radiation flow in the atmosphere? And that's exactly what we're talking about, Steve, aren't we? Different terminology use.
Yeah, it is. It's some different terminologies. And I think that if folks would really understand that what the radioactive materials are, or they're really no different than any other types of materials, it just so happens that that particular atom gives off some energy, such as radiation. So the way things act, whether they're up in the air or wherever they may be, is really just like they would act if they weren't radioactive. So take, for instance, calcium. Calcium would act if it were put up in the air in a certain way. And if it were a radioactive isotope of calcium, it would act the same way because it's calcium.
Well, that's until you ingest it.
Well, even then, even if it's ingested or taken into the body, it's a chemical issue, and the body processes calcium, whether it's radioactive or not, the same way.
But it's not going to. It may pose a greater threat if it's radioactive than if it's not radioactive. Aren't they telling people not to drink milk that had radiation or radioactive particles on the grass the cows ate?
Well, I think that there are some public health issues and some public health advisories that the government is providing, and I don't have all the information about how those came about and all the numbers right in front of me, so I'd really rather not, you know, speak too much about what the public health advisories are. But I will say that when something is taken into the body biokinetically or metabolically, it acts the same. And it does stand to reason that if you take a substance that's radioactive into the body, that there are issues that would have to be addressed, and there may be ways to rid the body of these materials and this type of thing. But I think the key thing to think about is that it behaves chemically in the body the same as its non-radioactive counterpart, and therefore physicians can address it in such a way.
Is there a good website to learn about all the differences between
there are some? There are some really nice websites out there that do that. Our website, for instance, orise.orau.gov/reacts. We have some frequently asked questions that are on there that address the various drugs that could be used to treat internalizations. The Food and Drug Administration has a nice website, a really nice one that deals with potassium iodide. The CDC has some other nice websites as well. But if our website links to all of those other places, so you can go there, look at the frequently asked questions, and maybe learn a little bit and link to some other places.
Yeah, I also found the Center for Biosecurity has an interesting definition site of all these different terminologies that people use. And, you know, in the old days, we used to call stuff radioactive particles that fell out of the sky fallout. Why do we not use that term anymore?
Well, I'd be honest with you, I don't know why that term's not used anymore. And really all they were talking about when they talked about fallout was the particles were put up in the sky, the material was put up in the air, and it fell back down. And so they just said, well, it fell out of the air, and that's where the word basically came from.
Well, maybe because it was so closely associated with atomic bombs and things.
Well, there is that association that's there. That's very true. And I think that sometimes if you can avoid those negative associations sometimes, that it would really help with the the public's understanding of radiation and probably affects the acceptance of that sometimes as well.
One quick question. Does materials exposed to radiation become radioactive?
As a general rule, the answer to that is no. Alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays do not make other things radioactive. There is a process called neutron activation. And what happens in neutron activation is the nucleus of a non-radioactive atom absorbs a neutron and is made to be radioactive.
All right, we're going to have to stop it right there, Steve. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Steve Sugarman, a certified health physicist. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, switching gears and talk about global warming. So stay with us right after this break. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How ready are you for the consequences of global warming, global climate change, rising ocean levels, stronger storms, perhaps wetter, colder winters like the one we're having now? By the way, while we were freezing here up north, the Arctic sea ice coverage was one of the lowest on record this winter. Some other countries like the Netherlands are taking action. They're building up shoreline defenses against a rising sea. And what are we doing here in the U.S.? How will the U.S. fare if we don't do anything? What's in store for our coastal cities like San Francisco or New York or Tampa, Boston, places like that? My next guest has written a book asking that question. It's called Hot Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Mark Hertzgaard is an environmental correspondent for The Nation and has been covering climate change for 20 years. And as I say, the name of the book is Hot Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. How are you doing?
Hi there. If you had to say what the biggest change in the next 50 years was going to be due to climate change, what would you point out?
The scientists say that we're definitely going to be getting a lot hotter and a lot wetter. So that's probably the short answer to that. Mm-hmm. It will vary, of course, by locality. It depends on where you are, where on the planet. But we're definitely going to be a lot hotter than we were, and there'll be a lot more extreme weather than before.
Mm-hmm. You call this the second era of global warming. Why do you refer to it that way?
I say that, Ira, because, I've covered climate change since 1989. And throughout the first era, the first era began in 1988, June 23, when NASA scientist Jim Hansen went to the United States Senate and testified that man-made global warming had begun. And if we didn't do something about it, we risked the habitability of this planet, for at least for our species. And throughout the intervening years, the basic argument was about how do we stop it? Is it real? What do we do? Who pays? But it was always a distant, far-off problem, very dangerous problem, but one that could still be prevented and that wasn't going to happen for a very long time. And we're now in the second era, mm-hmm. I would argue, because of a paradigm shift in the problem, which is that global warming triggered outright climate change, and it did so 100 years sooner than most scientists expected. And, of course, the big problem there is that the inertia of the Earth's climate system means that once climate change has begun, you can't turn it off very quickly. Carbon dioxide stays up in the atmosphere a long time. Oceans expand over centuries when they get heated up. And so we're basically looking at least now 50 more years of rising temperatures, even if we do everything right to reduce greenhouse emissions and to get on to, leave fossil fuels and other carbon activities behind and create a genuinely green economy. We're still locked in to 50 more years of rising temperatures and, of course, the climate impacts that come along with that.
And one of the impacts that we've been discussing over the years has been rising sea levels, not just because glaciers may be melting and raising the levels of the oceans, but because the ocean water, as it expands, expands. As it heats up, it expands.
Exactly.
And the Dutch are already, you write, preparing for this.
The Dutch are probably the world's leaders on dealing with, as the scientific term is, adaptation, adapting to these impacts that are now unavoidable. We're doing some things in some parts of this country, for example, in Seattle, King County, Washington, but clearly the global leaders are the Dutch. They actually have a 200-year plan for coping with climate change. 200 years.
And 200 years. That means they're going to be...
That's kind of inconceivable here in the United States, isn't it?
Here, 200 days is a long time.
I know. Well,
it's a long
my
time.
Editor, actually, when I handed in that part of the manuscript, my editor sent that part back with saying, typo, 200 years. He thought it was 20 years. I said, no, 200 years. But, of course, the Dutch have 800 years of history of dealing with water management issues. And they are thinking very long term. They're spending real money, about $1.5 billion a year. And they're making, perhaps the most impressive thing to me, is they're making very tough political decisions, including retreating from parts of the coast that are seen as too vulnerable and too expensive to protect.
That's what I was going to say. They're retreating from the coast? Are they building more protection to keep the seas out? What exactly
Both.
Are they doing? All that stuff.
Yeah. They're doing all of the above. Of course, they have the world's strongest sea defenses already, which were built, of course, in response to the terrible and deadly floods of 1953. But they began to look again at the science in the last 10 years on climate, and they are now deciding that they have to increase their defenses yet again and much stronger. You know, the general world standard is to have so-called 1-in-100-year protection for floods, and that's seen as more or less adequate. Well, the Dutch have always had 1-in-10,000-year protection in terms of the North Sea, and they're going to move that up to 1-in-100,000-year protection, meaning that they are protected against a flood that would only happen 1-in-100,000 times. It's a very, very small probability, but they say so much of our country is below sea level, we absolutely cannot allow any flooding to come through.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and go to our Facebook page at SciFry, /SciFry at Facebook, and also on our website. So they're way ahead. We're going to take time to catch up. I always wonder when I hear stories like this, has anybody ever calculated what it's going to cost for the whole world to do these things? I mean, you know, we hear people say that we shouldn't do anything about global warming because it's too expensive. But if you don't do something, the cost of not doing something, I never hear, you know, what's that cost add up to?
There have been some preliminary estimates of that, but it's even the scientists who are looking at it say that it's very rough. You hear the latest figure that I've heard from Dr. Martin Perry, one of the leading scientists in Britain, is it would cost about $175 billion a year to adapt throughout the world. Perhaps a better number is to look at what happened to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, Louisiana and so forth, after Katrina, which was only a Category 3 hurricane by the time it made landfall 5 years ago. And the damages, the economic damages alone, leave aside the human misery and the 1,800-plus deaths and thousands of people who were displaced, purely on an economic basis, $200 billion were lost by that hurricane. And I interviewed for this book the head of the one Fortune 500 company down that's headquartered in New Orleans, Entergy. And they happened to be, even before Katrina, were very outspoken, exceptional within the U.S. business community of saying, look, we need to deal with climate change. And one of their top VPs, vice presidents, said to me after Katrina that, you know, in a kind of a slow rage, that I am tired of reading on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal how it is too expensive to fight climate change. We just lost $200 billion here because we didn't invest $5 billion in proper levees.
And that's just one city.
That's just one
area.
State.
Yeah, one state. And
think about what would happen in New York City. You know where you guys are. Where you are in. You know, New York is for one thing historically overdue for a major hurricane. You're looking at least 3 feet of sea level rise, which is going to put a lot of Brooklyn and Queens and Lower Manhattan all the way up through Wall Street and the 9/11 Memorial. All that would be underwater with 3 feet of sea level rise and a decent storm. And luckily, New York City is beginning to face up to that, as is Chicago and Seattle, King County. But it's those cases are the exceptions to the rule here in the United States. Most of the United States is still not looking at this. And part of it's because we're the only country in the world where we're still talking about whether the science behind climate change is real. Nobody else is still talking about that.
And so is it up to local communities that are in danger, New York City, New Orleans, Boston, Los Angeles, to do this for themselves?
Again, looking back at the Dutch, they say that the top scientist there named Pierre Velinga said to me for this book that adaptation is inherently local, and everybody does have to, in their locality, have to take the first steps, because when and if this stuff hits, people on the outside are not going to be able or inclined to help you. That said, it is essential to have regional and national coordination and support And in fact, President Obama recently issued an executive order urging the ordering the federal government to begin to prepare to adapt for these things. So you need coordination. You also need, by the way, civic involvement. It's not enough for just governments to do this. You've got to have the population and the civic institutions and the businesses involved as well.
Talking with Mark Hertzgard, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Let's go to Ben in Athens, Ohio. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ira. I just had a question for Mark. I was actually wondering, given how the Dutch are adapting more as a nation versus, as you were questioning earlier, as individual cities, et cetera, Mark, in your research, did you come across any Midwestern territories or states in the United States that maybe were saying, you know, we need to develop economically, we're in an economic downturn, and if we begin our development now, even just as little as, say, searching for water in the geological table, making our, you know, Midwestern desert states more inhabitable, come the time when sea levels rise and people are migrating inland, did you find any states or cities that were maybe taking that approach that if we're not able to prevent it, can we adapt in a way that is beneficial now economically and down the road gives people a place to go that isn't necessarily a desert?
Yeah.
And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Yeah, I did find that. I mentioned it earlier. Chicago, the city of Chicago, has begun a real serious climate preparedness plan. And that means working both ends of the problem, not just what most people mean when they talk about climate policy, which is, you know, going solar and green and energy efficiency and all those things that are more important than ever, but no longer sufficient. Of course, we've got to reduce the emissions as quickly as possible because we're already locked in to very serious impacts. 3 feet of sea level rise is going to be very challenging to adapt to. We don't want to make it 10. That said, we do have to deal with 3 feet of sea level rise. And essentially, the approach that Chicago is taking is modeled very much on the U.S. leader, which is Seattle King County out in Washington State, where they, as they put it, ask the climate question, which means go to your scientists, find out what kind of rainfall and temperatures and other impacts we're going to be facing by the year 2050, and then work backwards from there to figure out what we need to do today to deal with that. And in Chicago's case, they basically have two big issues. It's going to be a lot hotter there, and there's going to be stronger storms. They have the advantage of not being on a coast, so they don't have to worry so much about hurricanes or storms, and they also will have adequate water supply. So they've got that going for them in Chicago. They are going to have to deal with more extreme storms in both summer and winter and the higher temperatures. So one of the things they're doing is planting a lot more trees in Chicago to reduce the temperatures in the urban heat islands. They're also beefing up their health and emergency services and public outreach and education efforts so that people know that when the temperatures are going up, that they need to take steps. They need to get to cooling centers. They need to check on the elderly and so forth.
Mm. We're talking about global warming this hour in Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Mark Hertzgard, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. So what I hear you saying, Mark, is that there's not one plan for everybody. It's every plan has to be local because you have different needs where you live.
Every plan does have to be local, but there are certain core principles, which is one, and this was when I asked the Dutch, what's the one piece of advice you would give? He said, start now. You are far more vulnerable than you think, and you have farther to go than you think. Start now. Check with your scientists. Take the science seriously. Stop this nonsense of pretending that it's all a hoax. Take the science seriously. Figure out exactly what the climatic conditions are that you are going to face in the years to come, and then work backwards from there. And yes, it is going to be mainly local. The localities will have different effects, but you're also going to need regional a coordination. And then finally, you want to make sure that your adaptation measures complement rather than contrast with the mitigation. That is to say, when you are trying to prepare yourself, don't do things that are going to make global warming worse, such as turning on a lot of air conditioning that is powered by coal-fired power plants. That's going to make the front end of the problem a lot worse.
You say that the government needs to lead a rapid shift to green energy. You hear the president talking about this all the time, but no one's listening, you know, in terms of making a rapid shift.
I think a lot of people are listening, but he is facing a Congress that is pretty in the pocket of big corporations and others, and unions and others, who are tied into the status quo. We happen to have, as one official I interviewed for this book said, you know, we're really an OPEC nation when you get down to it. Look at our history. We've had strong oil and coal resources and therefore industries over time. And they really do call the shots in Washington to the point that even a president like Barack Obama, who came into office clearly understanding the urgency of the climate problem. I was in Grant Park in Chicago the night he won the presidency, and he astonished me by mentioning the climate challenge as one of the three big challenges he faced as president. And yet he's come into office and done very little, shown very little leadership. When he talks about so-called clean energy along the same lines, he includes so-called clean coal, which is something that does not exist, is literally a coal industry PR specialist phrase that has no business coming out of the mouth of the president of the United States. So he, I think, has been a disappointment on this front, but it is largely because he faces a Congress where the power of big money so far still is overreaching the power of the citizenry. We'll see if that continues as he goes forward.
And in the last minute I have, what about this, the nuclear disaster in Japan? A lot of environmentalists were looking toward nuclear power as an answer.
True. You know, I wrote a book on the nuclear industry in 1983 and interviewed a lot of the executives, and it was the very first time I heard about something called global warming. The nuclear industry was saying back in the early 80s that global warming was going to save their bacon, because it was right after the Three Mile Island accident. Everybody thought the industry was dead. They were saying back then that global warming was going to help them. And it is, you're right, Ira, that a lot of enviros have come around to believe that. It's strange to me, though. Leave aside the safety and proliferation problems. The truth is that going nuclear will make climate change worse. Will make climate change worse. Why? Yeah, because of economic reasons, though. It's because nuclear is so expensive that a dollar that you invest in nuclear power compared to a dollar that you invest in energy efficiency, that dollar you invest in energy efficiency will save about seven times more carbon emissions quicker and cheaper than that dollar that you invest in nuclear. So if you invest in nuclear, you are making the problem worse by diverting scarce capital towards a dead-end economic solution.
Right.
It's really not necessary, or there's other ways to fight this problem.
And you can read about all these other ways and in the new book by Mark Hertzgard, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Mark, thanks for taking time to be with us again.
Always a pleasure, Ira.
And good luck to you. Mark is an environment correspondent for The Nation and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the future of cancer research. Stay with us. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. According to my next guest, one in three women in the U.S. and one in two men will develop cancer in their lifetime. And a quarter of all American deaths will be due to cancer. Why, after billions of dollars of research, a declaration of war on cancer that shows no overall victory in sight, should we now reset our sights on fighting this war? Do we need a new way to think about cancer? Despite the statistics, my next guest is optimistic. He's an oncologist at Columbia University Medical Center. He's written a book on the history of cancer to help him and his patients better understand the disease. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, and his new book is The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Mukherjee.
Thank you for having me.
Why a biography of cancer?
Well, I started off thinking that I would write this book as a history of cancer, but there were several things that, as I wrote the book, it became something more than a history. One aspect of it is that, of course, part of the book is a memoir. This book contains some of my own understanding of cancer as I trained in cancer medicine, and historians don't generally enter their own history.
And so it felt as if I wasn't just writing a straight history. That would be too inert. And secondly, it felt also as if I was looking at the same disease, for instance, breast cancer, in 1950, then again in 1980, and then again in 1990. It was like drawing a portrait over time. And that is, of course, in some sense, a biography. And therefore, I titled this A Biography of Cancer.
And there's so many personal stories in here. It's as if Oliver Sacks were writing this book. And I say that as a compliment.
I admire Oliver Sacks. That's a very flattering thing to say.
And you chose that as your narrative.
I did. I mean, you know, as I said, I couldn't have written this story without really entering the story myself. I'm an oncologist. I see, as much of the front lines of this complex series of diseases, complex family of diseases, as anyone else. And so it felt as if that I had to, you know, those stories are part of the larger picture of the story. But of course, as you'll find out, as you know, you enter the actual history of the disease the very first time. When was the word cancer first used? And also, what happens next? Why are we here today? What happened to the war on cancer?
Yeah, what happened? What were the mistakes of the past? And are there new directions that you see we should be going in, not to repeat those mistakes?
Well, I think there are two questions. First, what were the mistakes of the past? I mean, I think the one, I mean, I'm not sure I would call it a mistake, and I'll tell you why, but one very important thing about the past is that I think we imagined, as a community of scientists, as patients, as researchers, as doctors, we imagined cancer as a much more simple way. We really didn't understand the incredible diversity that lies in this family of diseases. In other words, one breast cancer doesn't even resemble a second breast cancer, let alone one breast cancer resembling, for instance, a stomach cancer. And this idea that there was a monolithic disease called cancer inspired the notion that you could have only one monolithic solution, you know, a lot of surgery or a huge dose of, you know, common chemotherapies. And therefore, it was a problem of the imagination in terms of the diversity of the disease. And that, in turn, led to a political idea, which was, you know, you could conquer cancer if you just poured enough resources into it. And this was back in the 1970s, and many scientists, said, wait a second, this is like launching a rocket to the moon without understanding Newton's laws. The second question is, well, what happens next? I think most researchers, most scientists, most physicians would agree that we are beginning to understand the so-called Newton's laws of cancer. And therefore, we are living in a very different kind of era where we understand the complexity, and therefore the future is about dealing with that complexity and finding both therapeutic and preventive measures that deal with that complexity.
So, and what different ways can we attack it that we haven't attacked it before that might work?
Well, some of them have already worked. It turns out that, just to get back to a more fundamental question, mm-hmm. What is cancer? Why do we use the word breast cancer and prostate cancer, even though acknowledging those are very different diseases? Well, one thing that's common between all forms of cancer is it's the uncontrollable growth of cells. They have several other features. I'm just talking about one very principally common feature. And it turns out that, in fact, the growth is regulated in our cells in a bunch of different ways. It's like imagining a car which has many independent accelerators and many independent brakes. And growth is regulated then by one accelerator going on in one cell, another brake coming on another cell, and so forth. We now know that that some cancer cells become exquisitely dependent on their growth on certain genetic pathways. And if you can target those specific pathways instead of killing growth in general, then you can actually get remarkably effective cancer therapy. And there's a wonderful example of this in a new drug, a relatively new drug called Gleevec, which really goes and targets the Achilles heel of only one particular of a series of cancers, such as a kind of a leukemia. So that's one aspect of it. And now, even until last week, we're learning that there are actually other pathways that you can attack cancer by. So, for instance, you can activate the immune system in certain cancers, such as melanoma, and attack melanoma by activating your own immune system against melanoma using a drug. So there are new mechanisms that are coming out which don't use the old paradigm, you know, let's kill all dividing cells and thereby obliterate cancer, or let's try to eliminate it as much as we can with surgery, and if that doesn't work, let's do more surgery. So I think that the front is constantly evolving.
I guess one immediate goal then would be to turn cancer, if not to cure it, but to turn it into a livable chronic illness. And
yes, in fact, and to some, in some cancers, that has been achieved already. I gave you the example of this drug called Gleevec. Again, it doesn't cure this form of leukemia completely, chronic myelogenous leukemia, but in fact turns it into a chronic disease. The disease used to be called chronic myelogenous leukemia. In fact, it was chronic only in the world of cancer. This used to be a lethal, fatal disease, but now it is truly chronic myelogenous leukemia in the sense that it is a disease that patients live with. And we actually think that many of these patients may have no different in their lifespans than patients without the disease. So therefore, it has completely converted into a chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. Do we need new ideas? Do we need new ways?
Absolutely, we need new ideas and new ways. I mean, this is a problem of enormous complexity. Again, as I said, part of the problem was there was a hubristic idea in the 1970s that, oh, you know, if we just poured enough money into it, we'd solved much of the basic mechanisms. In other words, we'd solved the Newton's laws, and thereby the next step only was to design effective therapies. We now know that that was not true. And I think that absolutely there are new ways that are coming. We've just begun to understand the genes of the cancer cell, but then beyond the cancer cell, there's the host, the human being in which the cancer is growing. So there's a lot of building of levels of complexity. That said, you know, I think the complexities are challenges, but one shouldn't go nihilistic about the complexity. We now have several examples in which, even though the tumors are very complex in genetic ways, in the ways they live, the ways they survive, you can actually develop drugs against them, and the tumors actually respond to those drugs.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Matthias, and is it Minnesota?
Yeah, Mateos, yes.
Hey, yes.
A quick question and comment type of sort of thing. It is well documented that the best way to fight cancer is just by prevention. Why don't a smart man like your guest work on prevention and try to put our energy on that? As we all know that once cancer is started, it's hard to stop, though. So prevention is the key.
All right, let me get a response. Thank you, Matthias.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt that prevention is the key. But what I would, and in fact, it is true that all of us are also working on prevention. It used to be in the old days that prevention and treatment used to live in separate silos. There used to be a silo called prevention, one box called prevention, and one box called treatment, and never the twain did meet. In fact, that word is old. It is not true anymore. I'll give you a couple of good examples. The drug tamoxifen was originally invented as a treatment for estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. In fact, very powerful trials, massive, enormous trials, have shown that in the appropriately selected population of women, tamoxifen can work as a prevention against breast cancer. The whole notion that if we've solved the genomes of many of these patients who would have a predisposition to getting cancer, to find oncogenes, again, you might imagine that discovery is really directed towards treatment, but it's not. That same mechanism of finding what the oncogenes are is being used, actually, for instance, in colon cancer to diagnose very early forms of colon cancer. So, in fact, the interrelatedness of prevention and treatment research is enormous, and the National Cancer Institute has recognized this. And in fact, there are very few people, I think, cancer biologists, who haven't got at least one hat on which thinks about prevention while having another hat on which thinks about treatment. And this is there's a lot of back and forth, much more so than you might imagine, much more so certainly had been the case in the past.
Eric in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi.
Hi. Quick question for you, and I'll take it off air. I am just curious, if we were to look back in prehistoric times and evolution and how changes occurred in different species, would that not be similar to what is occurring with cancer? Is it not changing the physiological or physical?
So you're saying it's not really a disease, it's just a mutation that's occurring?
Correct.
Well, I'm trying to understand the question, but in my book, in Emperor of All Maladies, I actually talk about the evolution of cancer within the organism. So, in other words, cancers evolve even within a single patient. You have it's like evolution captured in a little box, as it were. So if your question is cancer caused by mutations, absolutely it's caused by mutations, and those mutations actually mimic the same kind of processes that happen at a much more macrocosmic, on a grand scale, when organisms evolve. There's a mimicry going on, and there's a parallel between those two processes. But it's in the case of cancer, of course, those mutations are have a pathological quality. They invade, cancer cells invade, they take up residence in other organs, they metastasize, and ultimately lead to morbidity and mortality.
You mentioned in your articles and parts of your book the theory that cancer may have stem cells. There's an idea that there may be stem cells, and if you just leave one little cancer stem cell around, it could just then multiply back and show up again, and that's why people may go out of remission, because you haven't gotten all those tiny little stem cells.
Absolutely.
Is that still an accepted idea, or is that?
Yes, it's turning out once again. Again, we're facing a question about what is general and what is not general. I'll give you a good example. Now, in certain cancers, particularly in leukemias, it turns out that there are very clearly identifiable populations of these stem cells, which are like roots. And if you cut off the tree, or if the winter comes and it takes care of the entire tree dies off, but when spring comes again, the roots cause the tree to sprout up again. Now, in leukemias, there's one such population of cells. In other cancers, to give another example, melanoma, there appear to be either every cell has this potential, or it seems to be that this discrimination between the root and the shoot of the tumor is relatively arbitrary. So it really, once again, it's coming down to a question of it really varies from cancer to cancer, but certainly some cancers have stem cells, and eradicating those cells, we think, will be the key to fully curing the disease. Hmm.
Talking with Siddhartha Mukherjee, who is author of the new book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. In the few minutes left that we have to discuss, I get the impression from you that even though you've written this huge history of cancer, you certainly don't feel that the final chapters have been written about this, and you appear to be optimistic despite all these years.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the idea of calling this book "The Emperor of All Maladies" was to signify that we are sort of in mid pitch of our long and complex struggle against cancer. And as I just pointed out to you, I mean, literally last week, Ira, there were new drugs approved by the FDA, which open up completely new doors.
Let's talk about it. It's about for fighting melanoma, right?
Yes.
And what did these drugs do that others did not?
Well, for a long time, we knew that melanoma and certain other tumors were controlled or could be controlled by our immune system, because there were cases, very rare but very provocative cases, of patients in which their own tumors suddenly disappeared without any chemotherapy. So, and this idea that the immune system was playing a role had been around for a long time. It's true for several other cancers, but not all cancers, as far as we know. But there were many early attempts to try to activate the immune system against cancer, and they had not worked out. And the field was sort of full of dead and, you know, there was the death and debris of scientists. But then, through a series of long investigations, it turns out there are certain drugs that can activate the immune system, and in this case, work against melanoma. Now, it's important to know that these drugs are early in development. They extend life by 4 months, 5 months, 6 months in very advanced metastatic melanoma. Now, if you take that same drug and you apply it to a more early stage melanoma, you know, will you get that extension of life? Will you get more? Will you get even, you know, synergistic effects with other drugs? It really is opening up a universe, and this is happening in many different forms in different kinds of drugs.
So, using drugs to help tweak up the immune system so you fight it yourself.
That's right.
Because from what I'm reading in your book, there may be cancer cells all the time in our bodies that we're continually fighting, and they don't pop up until they get big enough.
Exactly. I mean, one of the questions in the book that I raise, and you know, this is from the work of other scientists, really the question is why we aren't all the time exploding with cancer. And the answer is there are several mechanisms that prevent our cells from so-called exploding with cancer. The body's, you know, there are genes that act as barriers against the growth of cancer cells. But beyond just the genes themselves, there are immunological mechanisms that act as barriers. So each of these points, I don't want to overemphasize the immunological mechanism. I think that that's just one part of many, many new different strategies that can be used to attack cancer in the 21st century, and they will be different from the ways that we attacked cancer or various forms of cancer in the 20th century. And that's what makes me optimistic.
Well, that's a good way to end this segment. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good luck with you. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, his new book is The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. Hey, podcasters, just a quick note to say that there'll be a slight delay in downloading of our Hour 2 podcast. You'll get Hour 1 immediately, as you are now, but Hour 2 may take a couple of days to process. But not to worry, it will get sent to you automatically. Thanks. I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.